I'm Sean Haney, and this is Real Ag on the Weekend. Let's get real and get connected with the week that was in Canadian agriculture. Real Ag on the Weekend starts now. Welcome to Real Ag on the Weekend. I'm your host, Sean Haney of realagriculture.com. I hope you had yourselves a great week, and we got a great show for you here today. Man, looking forward to it. We're going to hear from Werner Stump. He is with BC Cattlemen's Association, and there's a story going on in British Columbia known as the Cowichan Decision that is bringing much controversy in terms of what does real reconciliation look like? Land rights, and it involves ranchers and landowners and some of the local tribes. And it is a local story that's getting major attention after a decision made by a judge in British Columbia. So we'll get the rancher's perspective on that with Werner Stump here today. We're also going to hear today from Stuart Person of MMP. Looking forward to that. Stuart is, he's an Oilers fan, but he's an accountant with MMP, and we're going to talk about some of the things going on there. And then we've got a conversation with a great friend of mine, Tammy Arender. She is an ag media talent in the United States. I've worked with her a lot. She is out of Louisiana, and she's got a new cookbook out that for all you farmers and ranchers, or if you're living in the city in Western Canada, this is a book that you want to check out. It's full of great stories about Tammy and her upbringing and the connection to food, and some great recipes as well with some real Southern flair for sure. She knows how to cook. She is very well renowned for that. So I'm looking forward to hearing from Tammy today on the program. Now, if you have any feedback on today's show, you can send me an email, shaney@realagriculture.com. Or, of course, you can call the Real Ag Feedback line, 855-776-6147. It was a big week in agriculture. One of the big stories happened on Thursday. Parrish and Heimbecker Limited has entered into a deal to purchase Grains Connect Canada. Grains Connect, the 50-50 joint venture between Australia's Grain Corp and Japanese agriculture co-op Zenno, owns four modern grain elevators in Alberta and Saskatchewan, as well as shared ownership together with P&H on the Fraser Grain Terminal at the Port of Vancouver. Grain Corp announced the sale agreement, which values Grains Connect at $150 million on, like I said earlier this week, actually on Wednesday. And a quote here from Grains Connect saying the divestment follows a strategic review initiated after a period of challenging financial performance by Grains Connect. This has not been a good time from a profitability standpoint for the grain companies in Western Canada. It has been tough. Of course, there's challenges when it comes to some of the margins, and there's been challenges on the shipment of canola, of course. That's well documented, and farmers have faced some of those economic realities as well. But the fact that so much wheat is, what I've been hearing, is because of the push to move wheat, because you got to fill those grain cars that have been ordered, it has presented some margin challenges, not only for farmers, but also for the grain companies as well, as the handle in some cases has definitely been in the negative. And listen, with some of the struggles out there in the world of agriculture, there is going to be consolidation. A lot of times we talk about consolidation at the farm gate level, and that is definitely happening as well. But it's going to happen in the industry as well, especially in the areas where people are like, you know what, I don't need these losses, I'm out. Or maybe it's like, hey, you know what, I don't want to go through. This bad run could take a while. We're going to get out. There's lots of reasons for exits. And if you're a company, and that, whether that's farmers or you're a company that's making products and services for the agricultural industry, or in a very asset rich industry, you know, heavy capitalization required in the grain industry for sure. Better balance sheets. This is the time where they kind of win. And, this is no surprise. This is fresh off of that Bunge Viterra transaction closing. And I think there's going to be more. I think we're going to see more consolidation, not only in the machinery sector, the grain sector, and crop protection is another one where I think we are going to see, we're going to see more of this. More is coming. As we head toward the end of 2025, Farm Credit Canada is warning that Canada's economy may be facing more than a simple slowdown in 2026. FCC economist Christian Regasamy says the Bank of Canada itself is calling this a structural transition, not just a cyclical dip, Exports remain weak, business investment is declining, and uncertainty around the U.S. trade policy is already weighing on confidence. FCC is forecasting just 1.2% GDP growth next year, well below Canada's potential. We also had some economic reports out of the U.S. this week, some concerns about where job growth is or will be in the new year while they are having some economic growth. And the other report that came out this week was CPI really was under expectations of where people thought it was going to be. There's a lot of people that think there's going to be a revision because of the government shutdown in the later months, but definitely from those numbers this week, inflation somewhat under control. And a lot of people expecting the Federal Reserve to do two more cuts in Q1 of 2026. So we're definitely watching that. Another piece of news is Ford is rethinking its electrification strategy. And for farmers and ranchers, the shift is worth, I think it's definitely worth paying attention to, for sure. The company says the next generation of the F-150 Lightning will no longer be a fully battery electric truck. Instead, it will move to an extended range electric design using electric motors to drive the wheels while a gasoline engine generates electricity to recharge the battery. Ford says the new setup could deliver more than 700 miles of total range. And importantly, for ag users, improved towing performance compared to pure electric pickups. Now, I do know a few people that have that electric F-150 Lightning. They really like it. But I think when it comes to these all-powered EVs, it's the long hauls, the long distances we drive on the prairies where it's not as conducive to that. It's really a bit of a concern. And so that holds people back from going the EV route. Now, if you have a hybrid, which is what Ford's talking about here, I think it appeals to a lot more people, especially if you have to tow something. And we know if we have a pickup truck, probably we are at times going to have a load, especially in a farming situation. We go to town to pick up some stuff for parts, and or maybe we have to haul a trailer, like a flat deck. That drains a lot of battery very quickly. So having that gas option inside of that, I think it makes a big difference. Makes a big difference, for sure. So, yeah, those are some of the stories that happened this week. And, yeah, hey, you know what? I also encourage you to go to realagriculture.com. We did a webinar with Saskatchewan Farm Group, SAS Crops, and APAS on whether or not there should be weekly export sales reports. Fascinating stuff. We had a Canadian analyst that believes it's a good thing that change needs to happen. There was a gentleman there that definitely thought it was probably not a positive if that change was made. And we also had an American perspective too, where they do have weekly export sales reports. So check out that webinar at realagriculture.com, and it's also on our YouTube channel and our podcast network as well. Listen, if you have any feedback on today's show, you can send me an email, shaney@realagriculture.com. You can also call or text the Real Ag feedback line, 855-776-6147. Now, when we come back, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to hear from Werner Stump. He's with BC Cattlemen's Association, talk about that Cowichan decision. When we come back, you're listening to Real Ag on the Weekend.
Boost your yield and your bottom line with top-performing varieties from Alliance Seed, including AAC Weyburn VB Durham that features a solid stem for sawfly resistance along with wheat midge tolerance and top yields. Count on genetics that deliver. Visit AllianceSeed.com.
You're listening to Real Ag on the Weekend, hosted by Sean Haney of RealAgriculture.com on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. You're listening to Real Ag on the Weekend, hosted by Sean Haney of RealAgriculture.com on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. Big decision recently in British Columbia, being called the Cowichan decision by a lot of people. And I had a chance to catch up with a member of the BC Cattlemen's Association, Werner Stump, rancher from British Columbia, to talk about the impact of the decision for landholders and how it fits into the whole reconciliation discussion. Here's a portion of our conversation.
I guess, get us up to speed. What exactly have the courts ruled?
In August of this year, the courts made a ruling on a case that's been going on with the Cowichan tribes claiming Aboriginal title over an area in Richmond, about 1,800 acres. And in August, the judge ruled that she granted Aboriginal title on about 700 of those acres. And there's a couple things that go with that. One is that she said that Aboriginal title supersedes fee simple title. And so that's, you know, that's really important part of the conversation. And interestingly, she also added that the fee simple landowners were unaffected by the ruling, but that the Land Title Act no longer applied under Aboriginal title. So essentially the indefeasible title that we all enjoy when we have fee simple lands, she essentially said that no longer is the case. And so that's the part of the title you go to the bank with, and you say, okay, I'm the only one that owns this and has rights to this parcel of land, and I would like a mortgage on it. So that's concerning because that's not only in question in the area of concern in Richmond, but that concept of Aboriginal title superseding fee simple title has been set. And then you think about where we're at in all of British Columbia in particular, and that is that there's claim of Aboriginal title in practically the whole province, if not the whole province.
Was there something specific about this 700 acres that the judge went that direction, or is it not unique? And as you said, it could be a broader area than just this.
Well, certainly there was a specific story to the 700 acres and to the original claim of the 1800 acres. So there's no question that there's a story attached to that. And the case went on for 512 days. And so I certainly don't want to, I wouldn't be able to do that justice in terms of talking to you about that story. And every parcel of land in British Columbia essentially has a story that is tied to it with respect to Aboriginal activity, Indigenous activity. But the key thing is that this Aboriginal title is seen to take precedence over fee simple land. And it has a huge impact potentially to all landowners in the province. And, certainly as ranchers, we rely on lands to do our business. And so it's very concerning to us.
What happens next? Is there going to be an appeal? Does it go to the Supreme Court of Canada eventually? Like, where does this head next?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it's a little bit complicated in that I should back up and say that the fee simple landowners that were impacted weren't involved in the original case. It wasn't made known to them that they could be affected. In fact, the judge said during the proceedings that they would not be affected. And so they weren't involved in it. And so now at least one of the parties had come to the table and said that we should have been part of this process. And so we have that going on. And then we have an appeal going on. In fact, all the parties have appealed, including the Cowichan, who believe that they should be awarded the original 1800 acres that they were applying for.
Okay.
And a couple other Indigenous bands and the provincial government, federal government, city of Richmond. So they're all appealing this. But one thing that's really important for our industry is, we have to have faith that government is there to provide leadership and is going to be a backstop to this process. And that's where we definitely have some concerns, in that they essentially lay the template of this Aboriginal title over fee simple title when they did the HIDA agreement in 2024. And so they created this template. And then on the other hand, they were fighting this Cowichan argument saying that you can't do that. You can't have Aboriginal title over fee simple. And so the judge is sort of scratching her head saying, well, which is it? And then since the ruling, the government has not stepped out and said strongly, okay, you know, this can't go on. Fee simple lands essentially the basis of our economy in the Western world, and has, you know, put a full, haven't endeavored to put a full stop to it. They have, there's a provision to provide constitutional protection for private land, and the government has turned down that bill. And so we're really left wondering where we're sitting and where the government is going to, when the government is going to step up and make some hard leadership decisions and say, okay, this is what we need to do to create a balance for all of society and to move reconciliation forward, but to do it in a way that is achievable and makes sense for all of society.
Yeah, it's definitely taken the discussion about the follow through and reconciliation to a new kind of level that we haven't seen other jurisdictions in Canada for sure. Have you heard anything from lenders, from banks who are, you know, taking on that land title as a part of the security agreement they would have with landowners? Have you seen anything from some of the lenders?
Yeah, and it's really what we anticipated, in that there has been struggles with the people that have been either trying to refinance in that particular area, or that there was one party that was involved in a large development project, and the bank has decided not to proceed given some of the uncertainty in this area. So it is real. It's not, you know, it's not something that we're fabricating in terms of the concern. The court has said that this is something that will likely have implications for all of British Columbia. So they've spelled that out. You know, they said that this is serious stuff. The banks have said that, you know, they have expressed their concerns and have shown that they are not willing to lend under these circumstances with these unknowns.
Yeah, no surprise there in that conversation with Werner Stump of the BC Cattlemen's Association. Some of the concern that, say, lenders would have based on this decision made by the court. And what I find kind of fascinating is that not only landowners like ranchers are concerned, but also some of the bands themselves that are involved are disappointed in the judge's ruling and it didn't go far enough. And so here we sit. I would love your feedback on this. And you can hear the full conversation that I have with Werner Stump by going to realagriculture.com. You can also send me an email, shaney@realagriculture.com. We'll take a break and we'll come back with more of Real Ag of the Weekend right after this.
Excite your crops with inputs from Excite Bio. Access nitrogen and phosphorus with Excite Bio's lineup of inoculants and ag biologicals. Since 2010, they've been helping farmers harness the power of the soil. Learn more at xitebio.ca.
You're listening to Real Ag on the Weekend, hosted by Sean Haney of realagriculture.com on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. The following is a paid-for product spotlight by MNP.
I'm Lindsay Smith with Real Agriculture. Joining me now is Stuart Person. He's National Leader of Crop Services with MNP. Stuart, how are you doing?
Good. How are you, Lindsay?
I'm doing well. And we are, of course, now into the thick of the end of the year, which of course always makes me think about, you know, reflecting back, but also looking forward. And MMP made, of course, a really big move this year in sort of connecting all these really key pieces of the farm business together. Why is it critical for farm businesses to put those day-to-day decisions in context of long-term business strategies?
Yeah, it's a great question, Lindsay. You know, and I guess, first of all, just to preface this a little bit, is having a strategic plan is important to start with, which usually comes from some sort of business or strategic planning session. So if your farm has not done one, I would encourage you to do that. But once you have that plan, you know, that will help you stay focused and true to the vision of where you want the farm to go. And it's easy to get distracted. You know, you can sometimes find yourself making the decisions based on emotion or impulse versus need. So, you know, maybe if you can't ask yourself, well, do I really need this, or is it in my strategic plan? Why am I buying this piece of equipment, for example? So, and then another thing I would just point out on the strategic planning process is, you know, it's also good, you know, at keeping you grounded. So you got a lot of farmers have tons of things coming at them every day, right? And they don't know sometimes whether they should turn left or right or go straight ahead. And that strategic plan, if they pull it out and have a look at it, it quite often will help them identify, look, these are the things that I really need to get done today, And, you know, these other things can wait. So super important on a day-to-day basis just to have that plan and know what's in there.
Now, and as you said, I mean, it's a busy sort of daily of, you know, what has to get done. And then there comes a point where it's like, we've got a decision in front of us. How do we pull the pieces together to help make that decision? So how does something like data and insight, how does that help producers make more profitable, sort of smarter decisions that align with that strategic plan?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, really without good data and insights, you're really left making any decisions based on either gut feel, emotion, you know, past history or experiences, or potentially even some bad information that you gathered at the local coffee shop, right? So, you know, data and insights, you know, the data doesn't lie. It doesn't have emotion. It's telling you generally true facts about the situation, and it should lead you towards making a better decision when those decisions need to be made. If the data suggests that your farm has too much debt, then, you know, taking on more debt is probably a bad idea, right? And if the data suggests that you're farming some land that's really not making you any money, then why are you farming that land? And that's a really important one. We often ask farmers, why are you farming this particular piece of land? Well, I don't know. I've always farmed it. Well, you don't realize it doesn't make you any money, right? And they're like, okay, well, maybe I should get rid of that piece of land, right? And so, you know, those are some of the things that it can provide that value to you if you have the data, right?
So, and that's a really good point of the, especially as you mentioned land, there is an emotional connection though, of course, to some of the decisions we make. So I really like that point about like the numbers are the numbers, right? So the data is going to tell you whether or not exactly that piece of land has ever been profitable. And if it hasn't, unless there's some outstanding reason why, you know, that's you're going to hang on to it. Maybe that is a piece that, you know, you move on from, especially looking ahead to how tight margins may be in the year ahead. So absolutely. Now, this, of course, brings us to MMP has brought together, you know, has always offered finance and consulting, but, you know, has brought together operational expertise into the mix. What does a full service advisory approach then look like with MMP?
Yeah, good question. And, you know, that's really where the agronomy decision to bring the agronomy team into MNP was really exciting for us. So I'll walk you through a little bit of what I would expect the experience to be now as we have those folks, you know, in-house here at MNP. So, you know, first of all, you know, we talked about data and analytics, and we do have a data and analytics team that is specific to our agriculture group, you know, that's interacting a bit more with our assurance folks who are the traditional accountants who would put together a financial statement, do the tax returns and whatnot. And those data and analytics team members, they're starting to generate much deeper insights using the information that we have available to us to see how our clients are performing each year. As we get more of those insights and that data in place, this allows, you know, our clients to engage in some more industry and regionally focused benchmarking. So a lot of discussion about benchmarking in the industry, but what does that really mean? And when I say industry and regional focused, you know, if you're a grain farmer in Southern Saskatchewan, you want to benchmark against other grain farmers in Southern Saskatchewan versus, you know, a chicken farmer in the Lower Mainland of British Columbia, right? So, you know, I think it's super important to get the data in place and whatnot to be able to have those meaningful benchmarking discussions and see how you're performing in relation to your peers. And then as we go another step further, then we start looking at this past financial information, whether it's your financial statements. We look at some operational data, which comes from our agronomy folks and farmers themselves. And we start looking at the information that comes from our FMC teams or our farm management consulting teams. And the agronomy team, when it starts looking at all this information, they can start to say, you know what, we're noticing that, you know, I think you're maybe applying a bit more fertilizer than we would normally recommend our clients do. Or, man, your yields are not quite performing as well as they should based on the inputs you're putting in or whatnot. So we get a much more richer conversation going on. And that's not only at the farm level, but it's also at the field level. We can start looking at field by field. And we can even go inside fields and start looking at specific zones in the field or even down to the acre in some cases. So super powerful when you get that group going. And then as you move into an even deeper phase on that, you know, those discussions are leading to more comprehensive planning for next year, right? Because we start taking all that information and observations, saying, hey, we're not doing so well here. We're doing good here. What types of things do we need to change? And that agronomy team interacting with our farm management consulting team in terms of building business plans and crop plans and whatnot for the next year becomes super powerful in our ability to actually go out and help our producers to drive planning into what they would hope and expect is going to be better profitable results.
All right. So for those who are looking maybe to leverage some of that full service approach, where can they go for more information about the services offered?
Yeah, you can look us up online at mnp.ca. We have an agriculture page there. Or you can call your local MNP office, and they'd be more than happy to help find you somebody to work with on this.
All right. Stuart, thank you so much for joining me.
All right. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thanks, Stuart. Brings up some great points there. You know, and I earlier this week, I was in Hamilton, Ontario, speaking at a Ontario Soil and Crop meeting. And Peter E.P. Johnson from the Real Agriculture team was also on the agenda. And one of the points that Pete made is you really need to know the P&L of all your acres. And so you got to ask yourself, if there is an area of your farm or a portion of a field that is not making money consistently, why are you farming it? Why are you farming it? Just because it's there and because it'll accept seed and you can put it in the ground and hope that something grows? But if there's a part of your farm in that field and those 10 acres are never producing a crop or never break, you know, even getting above break even, why are you farming it? It's a really good question. I think more people need to ask themselves, especially in some of those so-so areas. We're back here on Real Ag on the Weekend right after this quick break.
Economic growth for agriculture, sustainable agriculture productivity, AGMs, and more will be featured at the Saskatchewan Crops Forum January 13th and 14th in Saskatoon. Register at sascrops2026.rsvpify.com today.
You're listening to Real Ag on the Weekend, hosted by Sean Haney of realagriculture.com on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME.
It is Christmas time, so there's a lot of cooking going on, and there's also, you're looking for some late last-minute gift ideas. I got a good idea for you. Joining us right now is a great friend of Real Agriculture. She is a writer, author, as well a speaker, and a contributor to RFD TV. It is Tammy Arnder. How are we doing today, Tammy?
Sean, it's good to be with you. I am doing fantastic.
Now, you have interviewed me many times on RFD TV in the morning. So this is a bit of a switch of seats here. I'm looking forward to this. So you've got a new book out, and the book is entitled Dishes and Devotions Make Every Day Delicious. Sounds very yummy, to be honest with you. Tell us about what inspired you to write the book.
You know, it's one of those things. It's been about 10 years in the making and about 18 months of diligent, okay, we're going to make this happen, all right? Because I had a publisher friend, and actually I'll say friend, I didn't know her. She reached out to me. She started following me and my little Taste of Tallulah. Mm-hmm. And I put that in quotation marks because Tallulah, Louisiana is where I grew up. It's the farm I grew up on. My dad was a cotton and soybean farmer. And so a lot of what we ate came either from the garden, or I also joke that if it crawled, flew, or ran across our yard, we shot it, put it in a skillet, put gravy on it, had a cornbread, and it was a great meal. Yeah. We loved that. But so she started following me and then reached out to me and just said, you know what, you really need to do a cookbook. And then I really got into baking and tweaking recipes and things like that. And I thought, I don't know if that's in me. But then she said, yep, you've got a story to tell. And that's kind of when the light bulb moment went off, that if I was going to do a book, it was not just going to be a collection of recipes. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a Louisiana girl. So I came out of the womb knowing how to cook. Okay. Yep.
And cook well.
I wanted it to be my story. The story of growing up on the farm, how important agriculture was to us, and how important it is now. And, you know, long before the farm to table movement, you know, came along. So I wanted it to be the stories that lifted up my dad and farming and agriculture, but faith is very important to me. And so I wanted to be able to have devotions as part of it, because I've learned a lot of life lessons in the kitchen. Mm. All right. Number one, being patience, right? If you try and rush a recipe, especially in baking, you're it's not going to have a good outcome. I've had many a biscuit turn into a hockey puck because I wanted to rush it. All right. So anyway, I just wanted to give tips. I wanted to give inspiration, and I wanted to lift up the industry that lifted me up, and that was agriculture.
Yeah. And the kitchen and cooking is really a way to connect people, right? And in a time where it's a fast-paced world and nobody's got time for really anything and attention spans are like 7 seconds, this is kind of a, you know, I kind of see a bit of a movement and a bit of a throwback to like, let's just take the time, let's hang out in the kitchen, let's do this. And we're not only going to share a great meal, but we're going to share stories and we're going to have a conversation and really get back to kind of that idea of mingling. I think cooking really provides that opportunity.
Sean, I wanted to bottle that feeling that I had sitting around the table, eating food that we grew. I didn't know we were eating cheap. I didn't realize that other families were driving to restaurants and going to eat out. We ate well, but it was more importantly about the discussion and the conversation around that table. That's where we connected. That's when we found out how our day went. That's where we found out where the challenges were and what the answers were to that challenge. You know, that's when I knew my mom and dad loved me. They wanted to know what happened during the day. And so I really want us to get back to that. Yes, do I want this? I want this cookbook to give you some great recipes and especially some Louisiana recipes, right? But I also want it to be that opportunity where you get in the kitchen and then come together around that table and have that conversation. Say, hey, tell me what's going on in your life today. Give me the highlights and the lowlights.
What is it about, you know, I've been to Louisiana a couple times and the food is fantastic. From your perspective growing up there and being passionate about the food that comes out of that region, what makes it so special?
You know, we can always say that, number one, laughter. You know, a lot of people say, well, everything's made with love in Louisiana. And it is. But one thing my daddy taught me is that he wanted to tickle my taste buds, but he also wanted to tickle my funny bone. I think laughter in Louisiana is, it should be a food group. All right. Because there are just funny stories. And my daddy was a storyteller. And that's where I got my storytelling from. And then, of course, I talked a lot, talking nose off a moose. I swear my mama prayed, Lord, I hope she gets paid for talking. And so I do. But so I tried to kind of wrap all of those things and also give people what makes Louisiana food special. Now, interestingly enough, Sean, my book, and this is crazy, I'm not saying this in a braggadocious way, But my cookbook is number one on Amazon in the Cajun and Creole cooking food and wine category.
Nice.
What is ironic about that, when I cook my Cajun food, like there's recipes in there for shrimp and grits and crawfish etouffee, you know, and things like that. But I'm really a baker and a pastry girl. But my chapter on Cajun cooking is called The Softer Side of Cajun Cooking, because they want to yank my Louisiana card because I'm not a fan of cayenne pepper. Because my deal is, if it's going to burn your mouth and set your mouth on fire at the first bite, it's ruined the rest of the meal. So I want you to have something that's authentically Louisiana, Cajun, and Creole, but that you can enjoy the entire meal and you can feed it to your kids.
As you said, the book is not just about recipes, but it also is about stories. But I want to ask you, what's your favorite dish that's in the book?
You know, my go-to dish, and I tell people when I go out to eat, because a lot of people, whether I was living in Nashville or, you know, you and I both have covered these big conventions and a lot of fun cities, you know, outside of New Orleans. And when people want to order things like shrimp and grits or gumbo, or red beans and rice at a restaurant that is not in Louisiana,
yep,
I won't do it. Mm. And I know, again, that sounds like I'm snubbing my nose, but I'm like, I know I can do it better. And again, most restaurants and most people outside of Louisiana who say, oh, I can cook a Cajun dish for you, what they do is they pile a lot of cayenne pepper in there, make it spicy, and they call it Cajun. And that's really not You know, matter of fact, Emeril Lagasse and I, we've been in the same kitchen together. And we both agreed that there is, it's not about cayenne pepper. It's about a marrying of flavors. And so my dish, my go-to dish when people come to my house, or especially when I was living in Nashville, everybody wanted me to come to their house and do a Cajun, especially around Mardi Gras, a Cajun supper, a Cajun dish. And so my go-to was always my shrimp and grits.
Oh, nice. I don't know about you, but I am hungry. Again, that is my discussion with Tammy Arunder. She is a great friend of mine in the ag media business out of Louisiana. Done a lot of work with her. And again, that book is called Dishes and Devotions Make Every Day Delicious. You can buy yourself a copy on Amazon. If you have any feedback on today's show, you can send me an email, shaney@realagriculture.com. And you're running out of time to get ready for Christmas, everybody. And have yourself a great rest of your weekend. We'll chat again next week. Cheers.